This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
In the past couple of decades, a lot of money and effort have gone into the fight against drunk driving, with positive results. One reason for the success is the ease of testing a driver for alcohol use, a simple roadside breath test. For some time now, there have been efforts to duplicate that technology to test for drugs other than alcohol. On today's Health Show, we'll hear an evaluation of that technology and hear where it's already being used.
We'll also dive back into the controversy about genetically modified foods and hear why some people think they are the cause of many food allergies, while others say that's a lot of all-natural baloney. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. If you've been drinking and driving and are pulled over by the police, you've pretty much been caught. Breathalyzer technology has been around for years and has led to countless arrests for driving while impaired. The technology has not been so easily available when it comes to driving under the influence of other drugs, like cannabis. In the October 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Marilyn Hustis, chief of the Chemistry and Drug Metabolism Branch of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and her team at NIH evaluated an on-site test device for cannabinoids in oral fluid. I spoke with Dr. Hustis recently about this technology, along with her co-author, Natalie DeRosier, a doctoral candidate from the University of Maryland. We started off by talking to Natalie about the role of marijuana, or cannabis, in drugged driving.
Cannabis is actually the most commonly abused illegal drug in the world. So if you look at in 2009, there was one study that surveyed people worldwide, and they saw that there was 125 to 203 million people worldwide who reported smoking cannabis in the past year. If you look closer to home, in 2010, 17.4 million Americans reported smoking cannabis in the previous month alone. And this is also seen if you look at drug driving. So in 2007, NHTSA, or the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, conducted the U.S. roadside survey. And in this study, they saw that cannabis was actually the most prevalent drug, and it was present in 8.6% of nighttime drivers. Cannabis is also the most prevalent illicit drug detected in injured drivers in Victoria, Australia, and it was detected in this case in 9.8% of the injured drivers. So it is actually quite prevalent, both in the population worldwide and in drug driving.
Dr. Hustis, what are the current practices regarding cannabis testing and roadside oral fluid testing and driving under the influence of drugs in general?
This has been an area where there's been tremendous research and efforts over the last 10 years. And to be truthful, the United States has been well behind the European Union and also Australia in our efforts. So the European Union conducted a number of tests and financed at a very high degree research in this area. And they wanted first to determine what would be the best biological matrix to do testing for the roadside. Because as you're aware, there's a breathalyzer test. And if someone is seen weaving or having any other driving impairment, they may be stopped, and the first thing that will happen is that they will do a breathalyzer test and determine whether there's the presence of alcohol. That can be done right at the roadside by a police officer. We don't have any such approach for drugs until very recently. So the first aspect of this testing was to determine whether or not sweat or saliva or urine would be the best matrix to test at the roadside. And after a great deal of effort, it was determined that oral fluid testing, oral fluid is the proper term for saliva, that would be the matrix that should be developed. However, at that time, the technology for detecting cannabis or cannabinoids in oral fluid was very preliminary and was not very accurate or sensitive. So a lot of effort has gone underway to try to develop these tests. Now, in Victoria, Australia, they already started random drug stops at the side of the road using oral fluid on-site tests as early as 2004. And despite the fact that the tests don't work very well, it has been seen to be a very positive outcome as a deterrent to drug driving. and that has been reduced significantly. What's interesting is that they actually used two on-site tests. The first test produced many, many false positive results, but the second test had a very poor detection rate. And so that screening then would, they would take a second oral fluid sample to the laboratory and confirm definitively with mass spectrometry. Another difference between the Australian situation and the United States is that, first of all, we wanted to wait to enact laws until we had good on-site devices, despite the public health positive findings that's occurred in Australia. And by the way, that policy has spread from Victoria, Australia, all across the continent of Australia. But in the United States, we require that we have a positive screening test and then a positive confirmation test before we report a result as positive. But in Australia, if a sample screened positive for methamphetamine or also MDMA or ecstasy, they also, in their law, said that they could test for cannabis. And truthfully, the positive tests they're getting for cannabis are primarily those that are positive also for methamphetamine or MDMA. But they have very good data to show how well the system works. Now, in Europe, after improving oral fluid testing, they've had roadside screening for a number of years now in multiple countries across Europe after their major research. And what they have done is go ahead and institute it, and on-site testing has worked very well for basic drugs like methamphetamine, MDMA, cocaine, heroin, and it has not worked very well for cannabinoids. And that's why this paper is so important, because for many years, many manufacturers have been trying hard to improve the on-site oral fluid tests to be much more sensitive for cannabinoids. And this is the first testing of this new device that has improved sensitivity to the point where now it's a very good sensitive assay for evaluating drugged driving under the effect of cannabis.
Natalie, are there any advantages with oral fluid testing compared to other specimens like blood and urine?
Actually, there are a lot of advantages to oral fluid testing, the main one being the ease of collection. So if you take something like blood, you will require somebody who's trained to draw blood. So oral fluid is a lot less invasive, and it doesn't require that you get poked and prodded. And then if you look at something like urine, it's very invasive as well, because it requires oftentimes that you actually collect the urine in front of an observer to make sure that the specimen is not adulterated or changed. So with the oral fluid, you can actually collect the specimen with somebody of opposite sex without having any problems. It's also more difficult to adulterate, so you can't actually add things as easily as you would with urine. And so it's thought to be a lot better representation of what is actually in the actual sample. And for most drugs, it's actually also a closer relationship to the impairment window if you compare it to urine.
Well, what about the disadvantages? There must be a few.
So one of the disadvantages is that with oral fluid, especially after smoking, sometimes you can have dry mouth. So it can be difficult to collect enough specimen. But usually when it is right after smoking, the concentrations will be so high that you will actually be able to detect THC in the oral fluid, even if you don't collect a full milliliter of oral fluid.
Natalie, what is so particularly novel about the on-site device that you studied in this paper?
Well, as Dr. Hustis mentioned earlier, there have been other on-site oral fluid tests that have been developed, but there was a lot of problems specifically for cannabinoids or cannabis. And this particular device actually has a lower cutoff. So the concentration that indicates that something is positive is actually lower than some of the other devices. Another thing that's quite interesting about this particular device is that it actually has an objective reading for the positive-negative screening of the oral fluid. So the device is set up to actually read the immunoassay and give you either a positive or negative readout result. And so you don't have to use subjective decision-making in order to decide if a color line is present to decide if something is positive or negative. And because of this lower cutoff and this positive and negative, it's actually one of the first on-site tests to actually achieve good efficiency for cannabis. And so that is quite interesting that we finally have something that we can use for cannabis testing.
Still to come, our conversation on drug testing technology continues with a look at other locations to use these devices. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1283.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Our guest today is Dr. Marilyn Huestis, Chief of the Chemistry and Drug Metabolism Branch at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and Natalie DeRosier, a doctoral candidate at the University of Maryland. They're co-authors of an evaluation of a drug testing device that appeared in the October issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. We've been talking about the use of on-site drug testing devices for roadside use, but there are other uses for these devices. So I asked Dr. Huestis about using this technology for workplace drug testing or drug treatment programs or pain management therapy.
What is so important about this on-site drug test and testing for cannabinoids in oral fluid in general is the fact that it can be adapted to the needs of the different monitoring programs. So we've talked a lot already today about the importance for roadside drug testing, to have a device that can test right at the roadside to see whether someone has been using cannabis and may be impaired at the time of the police stop, and why sensitivity is so important there. But in roadside drug testing, you'd like to have the window of detection be as close to the window of impairment as possible. You don't really want to identify individuals who are not impaired but still having residual drug in their system. In a workplace drug testing program, they want to have the widest window of detection as possible. They want to know whether hiring this individual in a safety-sensitive position creates a risk or not. So there they would like to have a wide window of detection. And that's the same for pain management. So pain management only have individuals come in once a month or less, maybe. And in those cases, they want to ensure that if someone is using or abusing drugs that could interact or could derail treatment, they want to understand whether or not that individual has been using drugs over the widest period of time as possible. And if you look at drug treatment programs, they have intermediate needs. They want to be very sensitive and identify if an individual has relapsed to drug use, because that creates an entire discussion between the counselor and the individual on what has caused the relapse and what tools would be helpful to them to avoid drug relapse. But if the person comes in on a Monday and is positive for cannabis relapse, they want to know that. But they come back on Wednesday, and in general, in drug treatment programs, they are taking biological specimens between once to three times a week. If they come back again and the test is positive, they don't want it to be from the original relapse. They don't want a wide window of detection because they won't be able to understand whether or not there was new drug use in the interim between the two tests. So in those cases, an interim window of detection would best serve that program's drug monitoring needs. So by selecting the analytes that you confirm for, so you'll screen for THC, but then by selecting which analytes you confirm for, and also by selecting your cutoff concentration, you can tailor the program to best meet the drug testing program's needs. So that's a very interesting way to take a single test and then adapt it to get the most information. And of course, that all relates to the way in which you interpret the drug test results.
In the paper, you state that THC was detected for at least 22 hours after smoking cannabis. What are the implications of this detection window?
Well, the first group of individuals tested in this study turned out to be heavier cannabis users. And so we are repeating the study where we are comparing the detection of different devices over different periods of time in both chronic and heavy cannabis users with occasional cannabis users. And this is important because, in general, many people believe that the period of impairment is in the neighborhood of 8 hours, 6 to 8 hours. And so the fact that it was still positive for THC greater than 22 hours means that you could still detect the drug beyond that period of impairment, which was quite surprising because we know how rapidly THC decreases in the blood. But now we know, comparing the light users to the heavier users, that there is a difference in that detection time, just as we found the very long detection in blood of chronic daily cannabis smokers. So that's why the 22 hours is important. It also emphasizes another really important point. The Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration is in the process now of deciding on the regulations and the cutoff concentrations and many other aspects about having positive oral fluid tests. These tests are going to go out, these regulations are going to go out to the public for public comment. And one of the things that is important is which analyte ought to be measured. Should we be measuring for the THC alone? Should we be measuring for other markers of recent use? And when we've studied this under our Controlled Drug Administration studies, we have looked for all the different cannabinoid markers. So one of the things that we think is important is it's fine to screen for THC in the on-site device like the one described in this study, but that when you confirm, it'd be important to confirm for THC, for carboxy THC, and for CBD and CBN. Then you have more information available to you to interpret the result. So that's why this is such an important issue.
Dr. Marilyn Hustis is the chief of the Chemistry and Drug Metabolism Branch at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Natalie DeRosier is a doctoral candidate at the University of Maryland. You can read their full evaluation of this technology in the October issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry.
Eighteen years ago, genetically modified crops were introduced in the United States. First, there were tomatoes, then soybeans, potatoes, and corn. As the years have passed, more and more farmland has been devoted to these plants. During that same period, a growing number of children have developed allergies to food. Despite assurances of safety from biotech companies and government agencies, the parallel timing has raised suspicion. Harvest Public Media's Camille Phillips checked out the research.
At this grocery store in Liberty, Missouri, some people are reading labels because they're counting calories or want to eat healthier. But Jenny Giles has another more important reason to read labels. She has to avoid buying things that could harm her daughter, Avery.
This is milk protein.
Yeah. Well, those are all right for you. It has allergen information right there. If you want to get those banana pops, I'll let you.
10-year-old Avery Giles is highly allergic to peanuts. Eating a peanut could cause her throat to swell up, put her in a coma, or even kill her.
I get really scared sometimes from the ambulance and shots.
A food allergy like Avery's used to be pretty rare, but it's becoming more common. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the prevalence of children with food allergies rose 18% between 1997 and 2007. It may be that more people report that their children have food allergies today because they're more aware of the possibility. Or perhaps, as some argue, more children in the United States develop food allergies now because children are less exposed to germs and allergens. But others point out that the first genetically modified food hit grocery store shelves in the mid-90s.
That means today's children and teenagers have been eating genetically modified food all their lives in steadily increasing proportions. Just because the timing coincides, though, does not necessarily mean eating genetically modified food caused the rise, says Rick Goodman. He is a food science and technology professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
We have to kind of look at our whole world, the whole context. And if so many things are changing in our diets, in how much exercise we get, in vaccinations that keep us from having certain diseases, in the number of visits to the doctor, in how many times we take antibiotics during our lifetime.
Goodman's specialty is assessing the risk of allergens in genetically modified products, a skill he developed working for the biotech giant Monsanto. St. Louis-based Monsanto makes some of the most popular genetically modified products on the market, including Roundup Ready soybeans and corn. At his lab on the University of Nebraska-Lincoln campus, Goodman explains the steps he takes to test the likelihood that products may cause an allergic reaction.
You put these little strips in here, and they're soaked in the extract of soybean.
First, the protein created by the added gene is isolated. Then that protein is tested on a serum made from the antibodies of people allergic to similar proteins. According to Goodman, this process is similar enough to determine whether a genetically modified product is at risk of causing allergic reactions.
Under the current system and products that are available, there's really no concern for a health impact from genetically modified crops.
But Jeffrey Smith disagrees. Smith is a longtime critic of genetically modified food who has made it his mission to expose the dangers he believes they pose and get the products removed from the food supply.
The process of genetic engineering can cause hundreds or thousands of mutations up and down the DNA, and up to 5% of the existing natural genes can change their levels of expression. And these are not evaluated in the superficial studies that are being done before the crops get on the market as food.
Smith gets some of his information from published studies, but much of it comes from personal communication with scientists. He acknowledges that there's not a lot of conclusive research yet, but he thinks initial findings are worrisome enough to merit further study. Many of the studies Smith does reference are animal studies, because there are few human studies.
And we know that animals consistently react to GMOs when their immune system is tested in a competent way in laboratories.
But according to Goodman, current animal studies only predict human reactions half the time. And he says testing people for allergic reactions can be dangerous and complicated, which is why researchers use human antibodies in pre-market tests. As for studies on people eating genetically modified food already on the market, Goodman says those are too hard to control.
And we don't know who ate Roundup Ready soybeans versus quote-unquote conventional soybeans. So how can you make a correlation, and how do you study a population?
It's fairly safe to say that most everyone in the United States has eaten genetically modified soybeans. For the past 5 years, more than 90% of the U.S. soybean crop has been genetically engineered. And soy can be found in a lot of different types of food, especially processed food. Everything from breads and pasta to meat and dairy. If genetically modified food were labeled, then maybe scientists could keep track and these types of studies would be more feasible. Labeling is one of activist Smith's primary goals. He thinks labeling genetically modified food will lead to customers rebelling against the technology. At a restaurant in Lee Summit, Missouri, however, three members of a support group for parents of highly allergic children see another problem.
I don't see that there would be much left to buy. And I'm already so limited, I'd be like, no.
Labels on genetically modified food could soon be put to the test. A ballot initiative to require labeling will be voted on in California come November. I'm Camille Phillips for Harvest Public Media.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.